I've been walking a tightrope between fact and fiction. Been wrestling with demons in small bottled prisons. Been talking to sinners who claim to be Christian, but shouting at leaders who claim to be listening. And the pendulum swings, but I can't stop the pull. Our elections are travesties paid for in full by a gang full of sellouts who worship a bull. Why can't it all just be free and equal?
Hi, this is Christina Tobin, and you're listening to the Free and Equal Network. We have David Bronner. He's the president of Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps. I've been very excited to do this interview for quite a while. David, welcome to our show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're a very laid-back guy. You're pretty easygoing. I've studied a lot of the amazing things you've done. But before we get into you, into your background specifically, gosh, I watched this documentary recently about your grandfather, Dr. Bronner. And can you tell us a little bit about, Mr. Bronner and really the background of magic soaps and really, how that's come about? It would be great to hear.
Sure. Yeah. So my grandfather, Dr. Bronner, was himself a third generation German Jewish soap maker. He was trained in the guild system of the time. His father and two uncles were basically running three soap factories in southern Germany. He was a pretty intense guy, from the beginning, and had a lot of conflicts with his dad and uncles. My grandma was ardent Zionist, and his parent and uncles were more assimilationists and thought the Nazi madness was going to blow over. And in addition, my granddad had all these newfangled, more modern soap making ideas. And so there's a lot of generational clash. So he came over in the late 20s to America and became a consultant to the U.S. soap industry and helped build factories and whatnot for P&G. In the meantime, the Nazi menace grew, and his two younger sisters got out in 36 and 38, but his parents wouldn't leave and were ultimately gassed, along with most of the rest of his family. Nazis nationalized the factory in 1940. So out of the tragedy of that experience, as well as a world of nuclear weapons, my granddad felt very urgently called on his mission and his spiritual insight that, in a world of nuclear weapons, that if we don't realize our transcendent unity across religious and ethnic divides and that we're all children of the same divine source, we're going to destroy ourselves. And what he called, we're all one or none. And struck out with, at the same time, the detergent or the soap and detergent industry was taking a turn of kind of better living through chemistry. It was sweeping across all industries. And so natural soap formulations were out of vogue, and more petrochemical detergent formulations were kind of all the rage. And, my granddad saw early on the ecological consequence of this move to petroleum and petroleum-based feedstocks. And so he struck out on his own with his own soap company with his family recipes in 1948. And people were coming to hear him lecture and, spread his peace plan. But then a lot of more people were coming just to get the soap he was selling on the side. And that's when he decided to put his message on every bottle of soap we sell. So if people are familiar with our soap, it's got my granddad's basically religious peace plan in very dense text on each bottle we sell. And, he basically ran the company as a nonprofit religious organization and gave away all his profits to charities and causes he believed that were, helping the world become a better place. And the soaps really blew up with the counterculture that just really appreciated that here was a real guy trying to make the world better. It wasn't just this kind of faceless, corporate, monolithic, soulless company. And we kind of became the iconic soap of the era and spread since then into pretty much every healthy store in the country. And then now we've gone mainstream in a big way, just as the whole life and well, you know, lifestyle wellness is integrating into the mainstream culture. But, you know, we're still keeping things really hardcore. We basically, even though my grandma lost to the IRS in the late 80s and lost his nonprofit religious status, we still, and we are now a for-profit. We run the company as if basically we are nonprofit, and we cap all our salaries and all profits not needed for developing the business or, you know, whatever goes into the causes and charities, you know, we believe are really advancing important issues in the world. So, you know, that's the basic background.
I don't know. Were you ever around your grandfather when you're young? I don't know about that, or maybe you weren't. And if so, what was he like? Can you remember any moments with him? He seems like when I see him online, he's a man that just believes, like you said, we should all be one. We shouldn't divide and conquer. And that's something I live by every day and really connect with him and you as well and what you've done. But what was he like?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he was definitely kind of 24/7 on the all one love message. You know, I mean, growing up, I mean, there's, you know, some family drama. My granddad basically went to save the world and wasn't maybe the best father. And so even though my dad oversaw the show production, there was some conflicts there that later in life they were, you know, able to negotiate through and reconcile. And, you know, my granddad was pretty intense. I mean, he was like, you know, he didn't want to talk about the Dodgers or the Padres, you know, it was pretty much 24/7 coming off the mountaintop and, you know, kind of preaching. And it was sailing over my head, I guess, when I was a kid. And it wasn't really till later. I appreciated it, but not really till later did I really understand just how amazing an individual he was. And, you know, basically I had to go through some of my own very intense psychedelic experiences that kind of opened me to the collective disaster of our consumption choices on the planet and just, you know, insane drug policies that were shredding people's lives apart. And, you know, just how important it was for conscious people to, you know, do what they can to make the world a better place. And that that's when I really started to appreciate and understand what my granddad was all about.
I'm glad your grandpa and your dad made amends, and it seems like the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree for many generations. Your dad must have done something right, because you obviously, in my mind, have a quite big heart and doing great things for the world, and I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, well, I think my granddad had, like, the cosmic vision nailed and the cosmic trip, and, you know, I definitely resonate to that a lot. But my dad was kind of, you know, he kind of rejected like all religion. He just didn't want to hear it. But was the most moral man that I know. And he's my central moral inspiration. And he just took care of, you know, his family and his community and what was right in front of him. And, you know, just an amazing man. So, you know, I really try and honor and blend like both their examples and inspirations.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I love the peacefulness that comes about, seems, in the family and yourself. And spirituality is so key. There's a sense of unity, you know, religion aside, and, you know, just the spirituality of bringing us all together. And even the music and the arts and the innovation, which is what we're all about here at Free and Equal, and learning myself, reading books about Tesla, and, you know, just a movement that's here to get the truth out there in the intellectual dialogue, essentially an intellectual revolution in a peaceful way. When the truth rises and we all recognize that, you know, wow, we've been played, you know, by a few powerful families that benefit from negative things happening in the world and, you know, use tools like the two-party system and mainstream media and so on, commission on presidential debates. It's just like, wow, our life is so limited every day here. It is so precious, and to wake up each and every day with no pain, you know, is a good day, you know, our health comes first. But, and so I thank you so much for the spirituality and really the things that you're about, David. I mean, man, I don't know where to start. I mean, you obviously love and care about people and workers and their rights. You know, fair trade is a big one for you, right? With what you do. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, like, you know, everything we buy and consume, there's, you know, there's p- people who made that product, and, you know, and are we honoring the labor that, you know, went into that? You know, granted, it was all about constructive capitalism, you know, which is, you know, like, obviously, you know, freedom is predicated on free enterprise, but, you know, you have to respect the earth and the workers from which you're making your profit. And, you know, just all too often, you know, the stuff we're buying, the labor is exploited. You know, it's not the, you know, it's just basically produced in hell-like conditions, you know, really bad wages, terrible working conditions, you know, children will often be involved. You know, it's just, you know, like, people don't want to know, and there's this complicit kind of denial between the producers and consumers. Like, I don't want to know about it, so don't tell me about it. You know, I don't want to tell you about it. So fair trade is about kind of breaking through that kind of denial and just making sure, like, you know, I, as a company, or Dr. Brown as a company, like, we want to know, you know, where are our raw materials coming from? I mean, who are those farmers? You know, what are their conditions? What are the, you know, is the pricing fair? And, you know, fair trade originally as a movement originated around coffee, where you have really volatile global pricing and really predatory practices with intermediaries buying from these farmers who are just kept in an impoverished poverty trap. So fair trade is basically a way of, like, making, you cut out the middlemen, you deal directly with the farmers and the, you know, primary processing operations. And you just make a deal just direct with them that it's basically market-based, but if for whatever reason prices crash below cost of production, you're not going to screw them. And, you know, and it's just based on respect and fairness. So, you know, all our major materials are now certified fair trade, as well as organic. You know, organic addresses the environmental side of sustainability, and, you know, we're poisoning our environment, our water, our bodies with these pesticides and herbicides and synthetic fertilizers that are fossil fuel dependent. It's a, you know, vanishing resource base, but, you know, these chemical conglomerates are, you know, making billions in the meantime, you know, poisoning and polluting the world. So you know, we get this, the organic is the environmental side of sustainability, and fair trade is the social human side. And so we, a tsunami relief project we were involved in Sri Lanka morphed into a fair trade coconut factory that now supplies all our fair trade organic coconut oil. We source fair trade olive oil from both Palestinian and Israeli producers, primarily on the Palestinian side. But just to be clear that we're not being anti-Israel, we also source from the Israeli side. And I have family throughout Israel. We have fair trade palm oil that comes from Ghana. It's a really cool project. And there's a lot of concern around destructive plantation practices, especially in Borneo and Indonesia, that are eliminating orangutan habitat. And so our palm oil comes from a fair trade, very ecologically sustainable project in Ghana. It's just, you know, really important to us that our success is shared by everyone in our supply chain, and that it's not enough for, like, a company to recycle in its head office and, you know, make green claims. You need to take responsibility for the supply chains and all the people involved, you know, and, you know, all along the supply chains that, you know, ultimately your company is dependent on.
Listening to you makes me so happy, because it's that hope factor of knowing that, you know, in whatever role it is we're given in life, whether for me it's Free and Equal Elections, or for you, Magic Soaps, which is just so successful. I believe it's the number one soap product in the U.S. Is that correct? I mean,
number one natural soap, yeah.
Natural soap, that is, yeah. And I mean, and to be able to be so selfless, David, and doing so many amazing things, because the dollar is so relative, the dollar, that green dollar bill, and to change so many lives for the better, whether it's in fair trade and workers' rights being treated right, you really struck really something with me with your efforts of helping out with the tsunami in Sri Lanka. I actually lived in Indonesia for 3 years and traveled through Jakarta and Surabaya, and lived mostly in Bali, Indonesia, and I speak Indonesian pretty well, Bahasa Indonesia. And, you know, just seeing the workers there and in other countries have a very slight sense of what they go through. And so I think you, I mean, every little bit, or even in your case, a lot, really makes, imagine if every person in your position, or majority, or even just more, stepped up to the plate and did what you did, our world would just be so different. I think one day it's going to be, you know, that way, a very wonderful world because of people like you.
No, thank you.
Coming together.
No, I mean, we were inspired by, you know, some real pioneering companies that were doing it right, and, you know, in turn hope to inspire others. And yeah, I see the movement growing. You know, the Fair Trade Organic movement is strong and growing, and we're, you know, challenging the industrial ag machine, you know, with more and more power every day, and, you know, creating this alternative economy.
It's wonderful. And I want to definitely touch a bit into spirituality a bit more. And you talked a little bit about psychedelics, but before we get into that, hemp, you know, the H-E-M-P word, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine in California, Todd McCormick, who's really big on the legalization of marijuana, you know, here in California, he's known as the Prince of Pot. Yeah, you know, and I've known him for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I spoke at one of his events and was at Hemp Fest, I think, out in Portland on the stage there a couple of years back. And so hung out with Todd, you know, and it was like, I mean, I learned so much from individuals like him and so many others. It's like, hemp, Christina, it's the most nutritious food on the planet. And where I was 3-5 years ago is nowhere compared to today. And I look forward to learning so much more. I'm 32 years of age, and I'm excited to even know where I'm going to be at 35 or 40 beyond. But, you know, hemp, I remember going out to Kentucky and we did a rally out there of like 30, 40 candidates at the White House across the spectrum. And I learned from the locals there about Kentucky and a big difference between East and Western Kentucky for sure. But, you know, in Eastern Kentucky, hemp, you know, being next to California, that's where they produce, right? The most hemp next to California, second in line.
Well, historically, I mean, currently there's no hemp being grown in America, although, I mean, let me back up. The first hemp crop in over 50 years was grown in Colorado, and we had a lot to do with that and, you know, helped our kind of heroic hemp farmer, Ryan Laughlin, cultivate, you know, 60 acres of hemp and harvest. And it was, you know, mostly symbolic, but it's really, you know, we really are turning a corner. So Kentucky has been leading the way in recommercializing industrial hemp cultivation and processing. Historically, Kentucky was really the heartland of hemp production in the United States. And, you know, industrial hemp was basically the world's most important crop up until about 150 years ago. And you know, in this country, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson both grew hemp. You know, all our founding fathers were, you know, hemp farmers. And, you know, like the first law of Jamestown was like, it was illegal not to grow hemp on your farm. I mean, it was just like such an important commodity. And, you know, and the world, you know, kind of made this decision, you know, or industry to base things on, you know, off of non-renewable fossil fuel. And, you know, we're learning that that's, you know, that's not a sustainable future for us. And so, you know, what are renewable, sustainable alternatives? And hemp emerged as a, you know, leading crop among others to, you know, provide sustainable solutions where it can produce both a food and a fiber, and, you know, like, and not compete with food crops. You know, the way like you have to grow cotton or food, like with hemp, you can grow your food and you can get the fiber for textiles, for construction material. There's like this amazing, amazing applications coming online in construction using the woody inner core of the cannabis plant. It's huge in Europe. It's actually the major market driver in Europe. Well, whereas over here, the main market driver is on the food side because of the highly nutritious omega-3 fatty acid content and really great protein. So, you know, hemp foods are just, you know, just exploding in North America, but, you know, just there's like a $20 million fiber processing plant going into Alberta, Canada. It's going to really bring a lot of what's happening in Europe to North America as far as the fiber side. That's really exciting. But, you know, Kentucky has been, you know, historically was the, you know, hemp heartland of America. And for example, when we as a country, for 2 years, we recommercialized, re-legalized industrial hemp for World War II. When the Japanese cut off our hemp supply from the Philippines, we had a massive hemp growing effort in this country. And there's actually a propaganda video called Hemp for Victory distributed by the USDA. And then, you know, right after the, you know, war was over, the, you know, the government came in and shut it down. And, you know, just the gets into the whole, you know, kind of puritanical drug war establishment and hysteria that, you know, gripped this country for, you know, the last 100 years. But anyways, so, you know, we're finally kind of coming through that, and we're coming through the kind of culture wars and getting to a more rational policy-based approach. And Kentucky's really been leading the way. In particular, Senator Rand Paul has been a real hero and champion. And we actually matched the Rand PAC, put $50,000 in restarting the Kentucky Hemp Commission, which we matched. And that really led, one thing led to another. And then we actually had Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, which I almost fell out of my chair, you know, come out in support of hemp. And, you know, we're really starting to see a shift finally, you know, a shift in cannabis policy generally across the board, which we've definitely been supportive of. But industrial hemp in particular is, you know, I would say this spring, you know, we'll see more hemp grown. And for sure by 2015, we'll start, you know, really seeing the hemp cultivation and processing, you know, blowing up all around the country.
Wow. yeah, I'm definitely all about legalize it, you know, legalize it, marijuana, legalize hemp for sure. And going back, I know, again, I want to touch the psychedelics, all that stuff, and spirituality, but I got to hit two more topics. I mean, Prop 19 in 2010, free and equal. I ran for Secretary of State of California in 2010, primarily because I want to set the precedent that if I can do that in my late 20s, run for statewide office, anyone can, you know, as I hope to inspire many people to run for local office and so on in the future and now. But during that time, I focused on two things, and that was, of course, to try to defeat California's Prop 14, the top two primary. Unfortunately, we weren't able to defeat that, but we did defeat it by a 2-1 margin in Arizona last year, but which was amazing because that was the gateway, right. You know, gateway for it to spread across the country. And it, briefly, we held a panel discussion at the Goldwater Institute, which is pretty right-leaning. The facilitator was a League of Women Voters, Barbara Klein, who's now connecting me with the National League of Women Voters, which is amazing to support what we're doing in our movement, fingers crossed. But we had a panel there, you know, the executive director of the Democratic Party. He just, I remember when we started off, he's like, if you ever told me I was going to do a discussion at the Goldwater Institute, you know, I would have never thought. But, you know, we brought these leaders, Republican, Green, Libertarian, myself, for a national perspective, and spread the truth, David. It was my real first experience of recognizing my measly thousands of dollars up against tens of millions or whatever they pumped in for Prop 2 in Arizona. We squashed it. I traveled county by county holding local press conferences, the gas in my car, you know, and booking a hotel and keeping it cheap. And, you know, the League of Women Voters said, you know, to us, because of your efforts. Well, it was because of us coming together and putting the truth out there. And I felt the truth, you know, back to California 2010 really lacked on Prop 19. I did put together a press conference, worked with Dale Sky Jones, and at the Prop 19 office, brought in Gary Johnson. That was, I'm a connector, you know, bringing them together. And obviously, it probably would have came out against Prop 19 no matter what, but I'm all about expediting things and held that press conference. And so I know you were really involved. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about your feeling about the drug war and, you know, Prop 19 and maybe a little bit about Mexico and the Caravan for Peace, whether it's law enforcement against prohibition or Drug Policy Alliance, the organizations you support. But where do you stand on the drug war and why in great detail, if you can?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, the drug war is like an unmitigated disaster. You know, like drug abuse is it's a health problem. It's not a criminal problem. You know, if you're abusing drugs, then, you know, it should be treated like we treat alcoholism, and, you know, you don't throw people in jail for it. And it totally ignores, you know, responsible use of especially cannabis and psychedelics, which, you know, I've personally found, and many people find to be important allies in our quest to be more responsible, conscious individuals on this planet. And, you know, and it's just ridiculous and basically almost like a religious war, you know, persecuting, you know, use of these kind of sacred agents. You know, and then, of course, the whole medicinal benefits of cannabis, which, you know, it's just this unbelievably, you know, potent medicine for so many different conditions. And, you know, because it's in the public domain, it's not patentable, you know, so pharma, you know, the whole pharma establishment's against it. Because they can't patent and profit off it, you know. Anyway, so you know, there's so many interests. You know, the private industrial prison complex, you know, prison guard unions, you know, the police and law enforcement. I mean, all these interests, powerful interests, are invested in perpetuating this kind of disaster of a policy on the on this country and around the world. So we've been involved in, you know, definitely cannabis reform for a long time. You know, industrial hemp's one piece of that. Industrial hemp's kind of like the most ridiculous part of the drug war, that a non-drug agricultural crop is treated as a Schedule I, you know, narcotic, which is ridiculous, obviously. But, you know, cannabis generally should not be controlled, period. And you know, and we're finally seeing the shift happen here in the culture in a major way. We were big supporters. We were supporters of Americans for Safe Access, you know, when it was founded. Personal friends with Steph Scherer before she actually founded the organization. And that's, you know, been just such a force for patient advocacy and patient rights to access medicine.
She's wonderful. Sorry to interrupt, but Steph Scherer, she took me out to dinner a couple of years ago. What a dynamite woman. Like, she just spearheads Americans for Safe Access and gets the truth. I mean, she is one of my favorites in the marijuana. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, great, she's woman. A force for sure. She, you know, she brought kind of these anti-globalization direct action tactics to the drug reform movement, and just, you know, we were locking down court buildings and just, you know, really just driving the issue in a really kind of direct confrontational way. You know, during the, you know, this kind of, you know, right after 9/11, it was such a dark time, but, you know, we were able to fight off, you know, the Bush administration, you know, attempt to quash the, you know, medical marijuana movement. And actually make some real progress, you know, even during the darkest years there. You know, and then Prop 19, you know, in, you know, 2010, that was, it was very disappointing, but it really did ignite the first serious national and really international discussion about ending cannabis prohibition that, like, wasn't a joke. And you really couldn't turn around without having New York Times and NPR, you know, having really serious debate about the merits and lack thereof of prohibition. And like, while the, you know, Attorney General Holder, you know, can't, you know, actively campaigned against us, and ultimately we lost, you know, and we had an off-year electorate, it really did set the stage and advance the ball so that Colorado and Washington in this last election cycle were able to punch through. And, you know, and, you know, cannabis prohibition, it's on its last legs. I mean, the House of Cards is coming down. You know, Uruguay just legalized. And, you know, 2014, you know, we're going to see a lot more states legalize. And, you know, hopefully in 2016, we'll be running ballot initiatives in swing states and forcing the presidential candidates, you know, to take a position just because if they come out against or stay neutral, the, you know, in a close close statewide contest, that might cost them the election. So, you know, we're feeling really good about cannabis reform. But then, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, like, I have a friend, Shoshana Scholar, who runs the Clean Needles Now project in LA. And, you know, the way we treat hardcore addicts, you know, it's like, oh, it's sentencing to death with, you know, HIV and Hep C and, you know, all kinds of transmissible disease. And, you know, rather than helping, you know, this addict population and, you know, while they're trying to get their lives together and offer, you know, trying to, you know, we should be offering treatment and, you know, avenues to get back on track to a productive, meaningful life. But in the interim, we shouldn't be sentencing them to death. We should be providing, you know, safe, clean needles. You know, just as a society, we just, you know, there just needs to be a more compassionate shift to treating drug addiction. And that we're also very supportive of that. And then finally, I'm on the board of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. This is an amazing group.
Oh, that's great organization. I've been hearing so much about them lately and look forward to them being a part of our movement as well. They're so amazing. Oh, please.
Yeah, pretty much, I think, doing one of the most important projects on the planet, which is, you know, integration of psychedelics responsibly in the culture. And, you know, their main project is bringing MDMA, ecstasy, through FDA approval process to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And, you know, MDMA has got just an unbelievable therapeutic benefit in a properly supervised psychotherapeutic session with people who have PTSD and resistant to all the traditional therapies, and basically are on permanent disability and are, you know, living a life in hell. And, you know, this therapy is just bringing, you know, peace to, you know, just a huge population in need. And, you know, you look at the veterans coming back from the wars, and just so many of them have PTSD. And, you know, and it's an interesting way of, like, kind of bridging this culture, counterculture divide, that the psychedelic medicine can heal, you know, these veterans. And, you know, it's just a real, you know, Rick Doblin, the founder of MAPS, he really does see his project as kind of moving beyond the culture wars and, you know, like, just integrating psychedelics into mainstream society. So anyway, so that's another huge project we support, and I'm on the board of that organization.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that. A close friend of mine, obviously you were speaking a bit about psychedelics before, and I'm glad you brought that up, you know, for being compassionate, the consciousness, and a really close friend of mine in this movement. Of course, I meet a lot of people, but this person I hang out with, and I just, all everything aside, as an individual, she's wonderful. Her name's Amber Lyon, and she is a former CNN reporter, whistleblower, a three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist. And so she has actually been traveling throughout the world and doing intense studying of psychedelics. And I think she's going to be really up, really at the forefront of a movement of getting a lot of exposure out there. She's a beautiful woman inside and out in every way. And just sitting down with her, and I'll be learning more about it. She comes back from another country, I think, come January, and her studies and her travels, and she'll be doing reports and books. And so she's definitely a wonderful woman, I think, would be great for you to connect with. And I think she could be a really great person to really help get the messaging out there, as well as MAPS, and which is already doing a fantastic job. But Amber is definitely a... I've never met anyone like her when it comes to this topic and psychedelics, and talking about how everything you said is very consistent with what she said in United Nations, and making it illegal, I think, back in the 60s, 65, and controlling us in the sense of where we're less creative in the arts, and we aren't thinking for ourselves as much. And she just, I look forward to learning more from her as well. And of course, MAPS and yourself after this interview. I hope we keep in touch, because I feel that I can learn a lot from you, David.
Yeah, no, she sounds great. And yeah, you know, you're touching on, the drug war is, you know, it's always, you know, the marijuana prohibition was, you know, like a racist, you know, war on Mexicans and blacks. And, you know, like Anslinger dreamed of rounding up all the jazz musicians in one nationwide sweep. And, you know, and then fast forward to the 60s, and, you know, for the powers that be, I mean, it was, you know, like, people were waking up and trying to shut down the, you know, this war machine. And, you know, and, you know, for, you know, our side, it was, you know, marijuana and psychedelics. It was like a liberatory avenue for us to, you know, assert freedom and independence of thought. And for them, you know, it was a crisis to manage. And, you know, and that was, you know, basically the war on drugs was, you know, the war on the hippies and the war on the counterculture. But yeah, I think, you know, we're finally kind of coming through that, you know, that older generation's dying off, you know, these older drug warriors, and just, you know, our side's just getting smarter, you know, better, stronger. So yeah, you know, hopefully we're going to get to this new era soon.
Well, that really is what, of all the things I researched on you, David, when you protested in front of the White House, and you put yourself kind of in a little jail cell, and just cutting hemp, which should, and someday, you're right, will be legal, for farmers to legalize it. And you ended your messaging in what was seemingly, or was, you know, not a nice situation. Very upsetting for me to see you get arrested. This kind individual standing up for the people and, you know, the role that in life that you feel destined to do, you're exceeding beyond, you know, I mean, you're just, and it did upset me. But at the same time, your tone and your demeanor of like, well, a great positive thing will rise and come about. And it truly called to me because it's individuals like yourself of what you've done to help better, whether it's fighting against the drug war or we didn't even touch the topic of GMO labeling. I mean, what you've done in Washington, I've studied 522, I believe, and California 37, your suit, Bronner versus Monsanto. Thank you for doing that, David. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, you know, I mean, we basically have six chemical companies that bought the seed industry in this country and are engineering resistance to their pesticides and spending tens of millions of dollars to, you know, keep Americans in the dark with the secret changes they're making to our food. And it's ridiculous, you know, I mean, now the, you know, the main engineered trait is Roundup Ready, is resistance to Monsanto's lead weed killer, Roundup. And they're blasting so much Roundup that now the weeds are developing resistance. So now they're moving on to developing resistance to, or develop engineering crops so they can tolerate 2,4-D and dicamba. Both of those are much older, much more toxic herbicides. 2,4-D is the main ingredient in Agent Orange. So basically, they're going to be blasting Agent Orange all over our food crops, and you know, and are, you know, keeping us in the dark about it. So, you know, this is a fight that's, you know, key to win. You know, it's basically the tip of the iceberg as far as what the industrial ag machine is doing, but it's an important tipping point, and I think it's totally winnable. You know, I mean, they own the media and the scientific establishment, but the cracks are appearing, and it's a very similar fight to cannabis reform where, you know, it's just, you know, for so long, you just, it's just incredible. The propaganda machine that the other side has, and the way people just buy it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. But we're starting to see the cracks appear, and we're making progress. And I'm optimistic we're going to be able to punch through in 2014 in Oregon and Vermont and actually have the right to know if our food is genetically engineered. And then that should be the tipping point, much like Washington, Colorado are for cannabis. And we should have mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods, you know, within a few years. So...
I love the optimism. I know you mentioned about initiatives. I, of course, Free Equal, this foundation, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. Somehow we miraculously got our nonprofit status given what's going on in the world with that. But I have a C4 as well, ironically, that happens to be a petitioning company that has gotten well over a million signatures to get candidates on the ballot across the spectrum, of, including Ralph Nader. It was national for him. His national ballot act was Premier 08 and successfully got him on the ballot in 45 states plus D.C. You know, everybody said, that's impossible, Christina. We only had enough money for 45 states plus D.C., but, you know, falling short was not an option. I knew that I would have to have that winning, you know, that record of just overcoming the odds to be taken seriously in this industry many years later, I feel, and hoping to become. And even the Green Party of Texas in 2010, we got 93,000 signatures, my petitioning company, for them in 13 days with 100% validation. So it's like I'm sitting on this initiative company that's done things that nobody else has, because my heart, you know, has been doing things that are right and believing, and I put everything into it. And I've been able to attract the best companies and individuals and leaders in the petitioning company, whether it's Naderators from 2008 to the best petitioning companies that work with Free and Equal, that do it right legally, even though the laws are flawed. So my goal is naturally all the issues we speak of, whether it's GMO or the drug war or, I mean, all NSA, NDAA, other things that we haven't even touched, is that I realized, David, many years ago when I tried to introduce bills or do initiatives, how they would knock candidates off the ballot. And that's really where I derived from back in 98 when my father ran for governor of Illinois, Jim Tobin, and was wrongfully knocked off the ballot. He's been fighting taxes for 35 years, runs one of the largest tax fighting organizations in the U.S. And I recognize that, man, the system of whether I try to do initiatives or pass bills, that they benefit from a flawed system. And then these people that are put into office, you know, it's a certain kind of breed, a different kind of breed, not like us, primarily the honest individuals. They appoint the judicial system, right? The people that make the laws, and it just is so stacked. And they just came to terms with the fact, David, that if we're going to fix everything all at once, we're going to have to drive a stake through the heart of the system. What I mean by that is create a movement bigger than the two-party system, outside of the two-party system, of independent individuals, we the people. And, you know, when I see the polls coming out now recently, over 60% of the people or voters, I have to check on that, consider themselves independents. And over 60% of the people, they want to fire every member of Congress. I don't like fire. I just say, let's just replace them. Let's not point fingers. We know what the problems are. And, you know, and let's just replace them and fix this. It can be that quick, that easy. It can be done in an election cycle or two, because we have social media and technology and these tools that our founding fathers didn't have. So I really am with you on the success that you've done. And I really hope we get to know each other better even after this interview, because I've been waiting to connect with individuals like yourself, David, that do great things in the world. And I've turned down, you know, companies and individuals that wanted to co-opt, you know, this movement saying, if you want our support, you have to work within the two-party system. Or if you want our support, we want to distribute these unhealthy products. Sorry. As much as we need that support, there was not a dollar that I would take, you know? And so mm-hmm. it was something that I felt was wrong. So I know. I just wanted to let you know where I'm coming from, because I really, really feel for you with the initiatives that you do. It is hard work.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's, you know, definitely the most direct democratic leverage we have is these initiatives, you know, that bypass the gridlock legislatures. But, you know, it's still obviously stacked in their favor with, you know, they got the money. And they'll, you know, buy off and snow people and lie and deceive and all that stuff. But, you know, at the same time, we are, you know, making progress, and it is, people like myself, you know, we're powering up and able to throw more funds into these fights and help power up these kind of people movements. And that's something they don't have. We have the people. And, you know, if we can just kind of, you know, get more organized and, you know, more strategic. Yeah, I think these fights we're winning on cannabis and, you know, gay marriage, GMO labeling, you know, we're just really, you know, just figuring it out and figuring out how to affect progressive political change. And just bypassing the two parties and just making it happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, regarding, you know, Rand Paul, yes, he's done some great things, but the party system doesn't work. It's a dead end, and whether he knows it or not, and a lot of fingers in the industry are pointing that he does, but I always give the benefit of doubt. You know, it's irrelevant. It's a dead end. I mean, look at what they did to his dad in Florida, the RNC, the two-party system. They would rather crash the party than let somebody else take over, you know, an outsider per se. And so, you know, I always like to, it's not really a joke, but it's so true that, you know, Democrats and Republicans, they like each other no matter what they say. And, you know, I've seen it within, you know, getting the Green Party of Texas on the ballot, and I got caught in a lawsuit there. And fortunately, it was settled and no issues, because I was going to go public on some pretty detailed things. But I saw from within how the Democrats and Republicans, it's a joke. They are playing us from the inside. I'll put it in a book someday, very detailed. And might I add, third parties, I mean, while I love a lot of the state parties, leaders, most always pretty cool people, the national parties, I mean, I've seen firsthand in this last decade of my life, especially 5 years, speaking myself at the National Libertarian Convention in 2010, that, boy, as parties become that larger, they inevitably become infiltrated, even the third parties. So I've really taken a step back. I'm like, parties just don't work. It's not the direction. And I look at the declaration, you know, the Constitution and mention of no parties. And it's just so obvious to me that the role of government is to protect the individual. And it's going to be these independents, and once we come together and recognize the issues and address it voter fraud's not really the issue. It's election fraud. You know, the voter machines and flipping the vote and the electoral college should go away and gerrymandering. And should we have proportional representation, instant runoff voting? So those are the sort of ideas that we'll be, you know, implementing as a movement and really educating, I think, those that are going to be inspired to run for office and take our government back. Really going to be very fast what we're doing. Right. Has to be.
Yeah, very cool.
So, yeah, and I didn't expect to do this, but I want to personally invite you, and whether you want to think about it or not, but to be a speaker, really a key speaker at our United We Stand Festival on May 10th. And I haven't actually ever invited anybody doing an interview, I think, but more so they're already confirmed, if not. But I would love for, I think the things that you do are so inspirational, David. I mean, and the initiatives, and they need to be heard by many more people. And that's what our platform offers, is to help open up, whether it's the music industry or Hollywood, or of course the electoral system that goes out of doubt, but businesses as well that do great things for the world. And in my mind, you're one of the best. You really are. And I would be honored to have you be a part of it, and Magic Soaps as well, to be given to our kids throughout the tour. And we're here to stay, you know, beyond the 10 stop tour next year, and conferences and social media live feeds. We're expecting international and local, and hopefully Google and others. That's the future, you know, Google and YouTube coming out against NSA. I personally invite you to be a part of that. I would be proud to have you be a part of our movement.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, that should be totally doable, and send me details and be psyched to, you know, help rock things out.
Cool. And I will give you a call shortly after the holidays. I think we have a lot more connections than people we know, and it'll just be great to get to know you. And David, while I have you, is there any website you'd like to plug, or initiatives, or for our listeners, any other issues you want to discuss before we wrap up the interview? All yours.
Yeah, sure. On the drug reform side, I mean, maps.org is a great site. VoteHemp.com is really good to plug in and be able to contact, you know, political leaders and, you know, get after them to get off their ass. On the fair trade front, fairworldproject.org is a really good one. Organic Consumers Association.org is a great resource for, you know, a fair food system. And yeah, and then our website's drbronner.com, drbronner.com. People want to check it out.
So everybody, I hope you got that. I'll definitely be connecting with Amber Lyon too, David. You're going to be just speaking with her. You'll see what I mean when I send over information about her. It's meant to be that you two connect. And I love that you're here to build others, and that's what Brain Equal is about. And I just want to, you know, thank you so much. I've never, you really are, in my mind, one of the kinds, and I will say that I will forever be using Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps for the rest of my life, and hopefully it's a longer one. You know, I think that there's going to be cures for everything that'll be found. That's beyond once we fix the system of technology and good money being behind it, and there are cures, you know, for all of this. And I think a lot of the organizations that you've mentioned are going to be spearheading a lot of this. Thank you, yep. David, so much for being on the show. I appreciate it. And welcome. It sounds like I definitely welcome you to be a part of our movement, and looking forward to, it sounds like, seeing you May 10th, as long as your schedule is good. And we confirm that up in the next week or so. So thank you for your consideration.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. And yeah, I guess we'll be in touch.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks, David. And everybody out there, go buy Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps. I've never promoted a product on an interview, but man, how can I not? And so I will definitely be using something. It's a product that I would be proud to have and educates and informs. And so thank you so much for joining us on the Free and Equal Network today, everybody. Christina Tobin, lots of love to all of you.